We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey everyone, welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another outstanding guest this week. He has been a top five player in the world in two different decades. He has also been the coach of the Russian national team. He is an acclaimed author about 12 years ago of the classic book From London to Elista, which he co-authored with Ilya Levitov. And that book won the 2007 British Chess Federation Book of the Year. And now, here right now, he has a new book out, which is available from Thinkers Publishing, the publisher, also available on U.S. Chess Sales. It is called Say No to Chess Principles. Grandmaster Yevgeny Bereyev, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, I am
nice to be with you.
I'm so excited because I have to tell you, Yevgeny, I love all my guests, but the guests like yourself who are incredibly strong players and grew up in the former Soviet Union, I feel like you guys have so much perspective, obviously, about chess and about the stories you can tell about the Russian school and about all the legends that you've played and worked with, but also just like world perspective, having come from one political system to another. And of course, now you live in Canada. So no pressure, but I'm excited, Yevgeny.
Okay, frankly speaking, you should at least pretend you are excited. Otherwise, nobody will come to you as a guest.
That's good. Yeah, I hope I was convincing.
Yeah, you sound as perfect as you could.
Okay, great. So let's talk about your book, Yevgeny. I've been tearing through it in this last week in anticipation of talking to you. And so it's called Say No to Chess Principles, and it's basically a games collection, but presented in kind of a different manner. And you talk in the introduction about signing a book contract. And what happened after you signed the book contract?
Well, I tell you that, first of all, it's not easy to work with publisher. Because you are trying to sell one thing and they accept, and they do not accept the thing. They have different opinion about everything, actually. And in the end, I let them make things the way they see it. I tell you even the name of the book I didn't really like. I was going to come up with something artificial and smart. So like, for example, my thought was to give title as like flew over exceptions. But they told me, Evgeny, don't try to look smarter than you are. And they turned, of course, it away.
Okay. Well, I like the title, and you did. At what point did you have the title in mind? Because it's organized sort of in my mind with the title in mind, being that the chapters are sort of arranged with various chess principles that you might hear, such as move your pieces towards the center, avoid doubled pawns. So, you know, you have kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah. I tried to sort things out. You know, just not to give. By the way, it's a book, games in the book. They are not my best books, games at all. And they even are not best for this topic. Because what I gave in this book, and actually I thought it may become only first part of the idea. Actually, I gave games and sorted them by certain principle, and I did not use in the book games with the two and more ideas in one game. Okay. So actually, games in the book, they're pretty simple. They're not the best, but I believe that chess players can learn something from those simple games, and basically the idea was not about actually a topic at all, because when a publisher called me and asked me if I write a book, and he actually gave me a clear idea what he wants to see out of the book, and with all those games you can find in the book, I worked on the idea he gave me. He asked me to present. And actually, I can reveal you a secret, which I tried to make indirectly. I don't know if probably I failed. Who knows? Maybe, maybe partly. And the idea was, and what he asked me about, to describe actually in depth old ancient time, how kids grew in Russia, what in Soviet Union, what meant and what means Soviet chess school, how the school organized the chess movement in Russia, how young players could become like stars and strong players, how the system worked in Soviet Union. And basically, in the book, you can find pieces of puzzles everywhere. And to pick those pieces and have the whole puzzle. I don't know if you found it or not, if you had chance to go through the book.
Yeah, I did read the book, and the fabled Soviet chess school is a topic of frequent interest here of myself, and I hope of...
Okay, did you find anything like this in the book?
Well, I mean, I know that you talked about you were a product of the Smyslov school, and... I'm always interested in the anecdotes about you working with various players and you crossing paths with Yuri Razuvayev, who, if I'm correct, was not at the Smyslov School. Is that
The head of Smyslov School wars. You and maybe people heard this name, Boris Pastovsky, who is living in Boston right now. Actually, he was the guy responsible for everything. He invited students, coaches, and all things he organized. And coaches, they just were hired, like coaches who could come for different, by the way, sessions, worked a bit, left, and so actually Boris Pastovsky was the head of Smyslov School, and he even read, let's say, homework and checked and gave us homework and everything. The guy was responsible. Other people, chess players, were not involved so much, especially when we call it Smyslov's school. I try to explain in the book that actually I've never seen Smyslov at all. Hmm. Because he I remember actually he gave one lecture, very, very slow talking, and I completely don't remember what he was talking about, but he was not, he gave his name, which was enough that time, and probably because of him, money was given to the whole organization. But Smyslov was not the guy, the one who taught us to play chess, not at all. So, Razumov, yes. Pastovsky, yes. And Dvoretsky, yes. But not Vasily Vasilievich, because he was actually very busy. And I tell you, it was 1978-79. In 3 years, he played the final candidate match against Kasparov. So actually, he was above or around 60, but still a strong practitioner. And he was busy with his career. And, well, we had a good time without him.
Yeah, that's a pretty valid excuse for not being around too much.
Yeah, but he gave his name. Yeah. So nobody could give money for nothing.
Right.
We had a few more chess schools in Russia, in Soviet Union, that time. One was Petrosyan, but Petrosyan passed away in 1983, so pretty quickly. And Palugayevsky had his school, but as soon as he could, he immigrated to France. And one more, Botvinnik, before Smyslov. But then, I don't know, just also it disappeared, the school. He lost his interest, Botvinnik as well. But, well, also some grandmaster of lower caliber organized their school. So, but this was is one of like one piece of that puzzle of chess life in Soviet Union.
Okay, and so, as I mentioned, I did read the book and I did pick up pieces about the way that the Soviet school was arranged. But so did you feel like it was a structured learning environment or more just you go, you get the lessons, you look at your game sort of thing? Or did you feel
no
like there was
no structure at all? No, okay. Structure at all. It's like in a wild forest. where kids come and who is more interested, who loves chess more, survives. That mm-hmm. was like that. And more talented, of course. But except talent, you needed a lot like devotion because, country was pretty big and chess was pretty popular. And it means that a lot of kids like joined the group, joined the game. And in different republics, different talented kids were born, and competition was strong high, difficult, and one needed all qualities to become one of the best in that group.
Okay.
So no real system I never saw in Soviet Union, but what was indeed organized, the system of tournaments. We had some good tournaments, and if you grew, you always had at least some good tournaments to play in if you were strong enough.
Okay, and speaking of the role of talent, if you don't mind, Evgeny, I'd like to read a little excerpt that I highlighted from your book relating to the Soviet chess school and Grandmaster Razuvayev. Is that okay with you?
Go ahead.
Okay, so you say, Yuri Razuvayev was head trainer at Vasily Smyslov School, and although he preferred to work with bright young talents, everyone benefited from his generosity. His lectures on Akiba Rubinstein's talent unquestionably helped develop my own play in technical positions. He advised me not to pursue a future in chess because he was convinced that one needed to possess a decent chess memory to achieve any significant results. I could offer a rebuttal today, arguing that chess is a combination of so many different qualities pertaining to knowledge and ability that one shortcoming could be compensated for by other strengths. He was right that a good memory does make grasping a subject easier, but former world champion Anatoly Karpov didn't have the best memory, to put it mildly, and couldn't remember pages of Chess Informant, unlike, say, Mikhail Krasenko. Indeed, this particular case can inspire even the most forgetful among us. So I found that fascinating. I mean, many aspects of it, but first of all, I mean, you have this this revered trainer telling you that you don't have chess talent. So
no, he didn't. Well, I talked to him later when I already became like member of Russian Soviet Union represented Russian team, and asked him why. I mean, what did you mean? He said, he didn't really mean, he didn't feel like with a memory like this, I could go far. And he said he really saw that I don't remember anything. And that was pretty funny because, for example, I had this homework. And Pastovsky gave me homework. And he liked, for some reason, gave me, he asked me to work on games of, like, strong players. And we had this, they had coaches, they had ideas that you should work on games of Capablanca and Aleki. And each time he was saying, like, don't forget, work on Alekhine's games. And I was coming to next session, and he said, he could ask, okay, show me a game. I say, I'm sorry, I don't remember a game. But he asked me, okay, but did you work on it? I say, yes, I did. And I just checked 100 games. And why cannot you show me up anything? Just I don't remember.
And it was true. You did work on it, right? You're not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. I tell you, even I tried to remember, but I couldn't. And of course, they first of all believed me, and Razuvayev believed me, and he saw that really the guy he cannot remember anything. How can he play chess? Huh. So probably they didn't have this precedent or something like that. Word like this, precedent.
So precedent.
Precedent that someone with, despite probably Karpov had the even better memory than I had.
That Karpov did? But so how did you know that, like, did you experience Karpov's memory personally, or did you just hear because, that his memory wasn't?
Many GM worked for Karpov.
Mm-hmm.
And that they told stories about how they tried to give Karpov information, but he could not remember. And also from those people, information that Karpov regularly took notes for games, because simply he had a lot of analysis, and because he could not remember those analyses, and he had to take notes. But later, also there was information. I think it can be true that Kasparov also used the same system, and also he used the notes and took it for games, but for different reason already. Despite Kasparov had a perfect memory, but the amount of analysis Kasparov had and the depth and the quality was so deep, huge, and strong that he could not remember those analyses well.
Mm-hmm.
Just physically it was impossible. And can you imagine what's going on these days?
Yeah, I really can't.
Okay, so they use those notes.
So
and I did not, but that was the fact. So Razuvayev, in fact, if we return, he did not think I was untalented. Let's say no, he thought that just chess players should remember at least something. I could.
That's funny. So maybe he was talking more about you. Your potential to become world champion rather than your potential to...
My potential to be GM, for example.
Oh, wow. So you exceeded his expectations, it's safe to say.
Well,
even though it sounds like he tried to walk it back later.
My own expectation. I exceeded everyone's expectations.
So how do you think you pulled that off? What traits did you have that helped make up for not having a... elite chess player level memory?
I explained it those quotes, actually. The thing is that you, a human, can organize himself to develop, to create himself in many aspects. And memory is one thing, but also if you work a lot, you can... just understand by your play by fingers and skin, let's put it this way. And you don't need to remember. You just know where pieces go.
Mm-hmm.
And also it all depends how much you love chess and how long you are. For how long you are with chess, what, how you devoted to the game. And the thing is, simply I had to work on chess much more, way more than other chess players, and that's it.
So,
and it was a bit inconvenient, because I did not have my private life for many, many years, been in my youth. But that's price you have to pay if you don't have chess memory.
Interesting.
And also, I tell you what I had to do. I could not play many openings because simply I did not remember. And I was very, very limited. And actually, because of that, I also could not achieve good results because... I could not play, I could not surprise people.
Right.
They always could be well prepared, and that's why I lost a lot of short games, because simply one mistake and bad opening, and the opening becomes even worse.
Okay.
So actually, it was a bit inconvenient to have memory like I do.
Yeah, well, but it's encouraging for any listeners who, any younger listeners who are working hard on their chess, or even for adults who feel like their memory isn't great and just like at the club level want to get better. It's encouraging to know that you were able to attain such heights and
Don't worry. Everyone has better memory than I do, and memory cannot stop people to become a good player. Just laziness, yes, but not bad memory.
Oh, excellent advice. And I guess one could infer from what you said that if you have a bad memory, it might be a reasonable plan to adopt a more narrow repertoire.
I had to, yes. And yeah. It's better to have widespread repertoire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. This is all related to the book, but getting back to the book a little bit. To what extent do you feel like this is just a way to arrange and show some different themes about chess players not being too dogmatic about following themes? And like, how strongly do you feel that chess principles are kind of overrated, or do you not feel that way at all?
So when you don't follow chess principles, in fact, somehow you follow them, but that's what we should understand, that we do things correctly. And one what actually mean? Well, for example, I pick an example. Oh, for example, I'm saying that piece usually does not stay well in the central square. And when you come to chess, everyone will tell you, just place a knight in the center and knight is always great there. But in the book, I show that it's not completely true. Why? Because a knight in the center gets 8 squares, covers 8 squares. A knight in the corner covers only 2. But maybe you need to cover exactly one of those 2 squares. And in this case, your knight should not be in the center, but just somewhere in the corner. Something like that. Right. Anyway, the thing is, you need to attack, to defend something important in the position. And the thing is, when you play, you're trying to find out position, to find out what is really important. And you play according to position need. And if position, for example, demands an open file, and the way how you can get this open file only to double or triple your pawns, then you should triple them. Something like that. Chess is actually, basically, of course, is a game with certain rules. But we all can say it with some exceptions. But it's not about, we don't break rules. We just follow specific need on every position. And in this case, we can, it may seem that we break a rule. Or we can say we break a rule. But in fact, we don't. Just it's complicated. That's why, by the way, very difficult to play chess.
Yeah,
why?
Exactly.
Because when you study, when you learn, and you help someone to be a chess player, you nevertheless should give some basic principles to follow. Just otherwise, a kid, he does not know what to do. Right, what to do? Why knight should go to the center? Because knight covers more squares over there, something like that. But only when a person is involved for some time in chess and he spends like half of his life with chess, he will understand the real motives of moves in a particular specific position. So that's why I'm saying that the main thing in chess is not actually being talented. It's to be with chess and analyze a lot of stuff. Games, typical positions, typical endings, and so on. So that's why, who is world champion these days? Magnus Carlsen. What he was famous about? Okay, he dedicated the game since maybe five. I'm traveling all around Europe playing tournaments, and probably he did not go to school, or not regular at least. So the thing is, you want to achieve something somewhere, probably in any area, you should sacrifice something. Mm-hmm. Good thing, for example, like for Carlson, for him probably to think about chess, to be in chess, is not sacrifice at all. So he's lucky person. But for example, I may say that Kramnik probably, for Kramnik, like example, now to be and to work on chess is sacrifice. And he does not like to sacrifice anymore, any longer. So he quit.
Were you surprised by his retiring?
No, because he looks like a person who just had enough for chess, and he is not enjoying any longer tour work on that complicated opening problems, and he does not enjoy playing youngsters who are full of energy and just calculate and play with eager and desire. And it's sooner or later everyone stops playing chess. So for him, time came. And I tell you, actually, it's pretty much all right if one stops around 40, 45, or as I feel. The only, of course, exception is Anand, who probably can play another 10 years. But, first of all, his life since young age was dedicated to chess. Everything is well organized in his life. And in fact, he loves chess and to play chess and to win so much. And his talent is incredible, and his health is good and everything. So, but he's more like exception, like Smyslov, for example, in 80s. Also, at 60 to play on the level he played was something extraordinary. But not everybody can go that high. But it's a good example for those players and chess players who just don't want to stop and want to play more and more. Gelfand is there and he's fighting hard. So I admire those people very much. And I wish I could be like them. But for example, I personally stopped enjoying playing chess, stopped enjoying working on chess so hard. I did not have resources myself. And probably Kramnik came to the same point and decided, okay, it's time to do something else.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. You can.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. I'm more or less done.
Okay. Well, I was just gonna contrast to that too. In From London to Elista, you and Ilya Levitov talk about how building up to his world championship match against Garry Kasparov, it was kind of the complete opposite. How he was in absolute peak form physically and mentally.
I was saying that, but I tell you that if you shouldn't take my books like
the gospel, right?
Like you should take them like fiction.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's they are not. I don't mean all I say there. It's based on true story. It's not like true story. It's not completely fiction. It's based on true story.
Okay.
I use some facts, but this is actually more like fiction, fiction's books. And I say something, but I probably not always mean it.
That's
and for
interesting.
Example, if we are talking about what I'm saying, peak of Kramnik, well, if you look at the games they played, if you analyze the games, you can see that they were so nervous.
Yeah.
They were making so many mistakes there. Kasparov played like the worst chess event ever in London. Where after Kramnik took the lead, a quality of his games dropped significantly, and also he was not. Especially second part of the tournament was not his peak at all. So, but the thing is, even if we're talking about my last book, it's all I'm giving there, all stories I'm giving, they have something. Something could be true in those stories, but that's fiction. I try to make book interesting. I tell you more. For example, if I take same facts, I recall them, and if not looking at the book, you give me chance to write another book with the same stories. Well, ideas and stories can end differently.
So that's very funny. Now, of course, I'm wondering which parts are true, which parts are not true.
Exactly.
an air of mystery.
Don't take it seriously.
Okay. Well, I do want to ask you. Okay, is this sentence from the book to be taken seriously or not? Ilya Levit.
I won't tell you. It's not interesting. You should decide for yourself. You take it seriously or not.
Wow, this is like the, I don't know if you know this pop culture reference, but the conclusion to The Sopranos where the screen goes black and the, you know, the creator of the show, David Chase, won't talk about what it means. You just have to, your job is to make the art and our job is to interpret it.
Exactly, something like that, because it's a book. So I write some words there. And for example, if you read a novel, so you read what's going on then, and then you think, well, actually you try to find out yourself what does it mean, what Dostoevsky was going to say. I'm far from being Dostoevsky or something, but don't take it this way. But anyway, I'd like my readers think about life and everything.
Okay.
And that's how it went. I told them some stories, but partly even the information not false.
Okay. Yeah, because I had the opportunity to talk to Carsten Henzel, who recently wrote a book about Vladimir Kramnik, and he also made some allusions to having different memories of a few things presented from London to Elisa.
Well, maybe he has his own view, and I'm frankly speaking, don't remember him there. Probably
okay.
He was in the same building with me, but I worked with coaches, and probably he was more like working with Vlad and talking to him and something like that.
Yeah.
I remember Kramnik and coaches there, and doctor as well.
Right, and the chef, right?
Remember Karsten there.
Okay.
I remember him very well when we played the second match with Lika.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, because he managed both players. Okay, so what about the stories in Say No to Chess Principles? Is there some poetic license with those as well? You know, like I highlighted a few of my favorite stories. Getting sick at the Moscow Open in 2010.
That was more or less like that. A bit in the it presented in a poetic way.
Mm-hmm. As but, it should be. Yeah.
Yeah, but indeed, I was very sick there, and if something went a bit differently, I would just have stopped playing the tournament after round three. That's it. But I was very sick, and surprisingly, I somehow recovered pretty fast, and it was a pleasant memory. The thing is, one moment you think the tournament is over, in the 5 days you win pretty strong event. So that was a good memory.
Good. And probably not as good a memory. You talk in discussing Peter Lecoq after the match with Kramnik. He didn't really maintain his level as like one of the top five players in the world. And you compared it to when you you lost the World Under 20 Championship and talked about how difficult that was. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that experience of coming so close to winning something and having it not come to fruition?
I tell you what, one should not be emotional or too emotional being in sport, because chess is these days is more like sport. And you lose, you win, and you should take it like a sport. I like NHL and NBA. Why? Because they lose game, like maybe a series of games, and then they come and play like nothing happened. And being emotional, being not professional, I don't know. I took all my defeats too seriously, because maybe I felt much about myself, I should not. And indeed, I suffered like I almost died, or someone, or my I don't know, my relatives died, like only by losing a world champion under 20 title. Well, yes, indeed, I for 3 years I was broken.
Wow, three years.
I could not play. I could not recover. My health was not good, and so on. But that only describes me like a very, very unprofessional chess player at that time. And I probably managed to overcome that shortcoming and to change the situation for good, for better. And I returned to high level. And in 3 years, I fully recovered, because in 3 years, I retained the same level, even increased my chess level, and I learned to stand defeats much better. So actually, I can tell you that one can use chess like a field to grow in different aspects. So like, I don't know, character, to grow, to build, to forge character. So I was not good, frankly. I took it too seriously, unprofessionally, and Leaker, he also suffered, and also he went down. But in his case, maybe things are different. First of all, the level he played was higher. Defeat he suffered was like much higher, and to lose real world championship title is real something. Well, to lose tournament under 20, well, what a big deal, in fact. It's just one step. So many world champions under 20 who never became good players. So it's not very important. But to lose world championship match in a manner Peter did, that's painful.
Yeah.
And still, I tell you that, as I also mentioned in the book, next year he played very well, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, yes, he his level, I mean, the quality of his chess declined gradually, and he became old, and then again, new talented players came to chess, and it was not that simple to hold the door, to hold the level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, still probably he could take it better, that defeat. But I would not blame him and would not compare, in fact, my case and his case. Because mine, it's well childish, and his was just something real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So if I know that you've coached the Russian national team, you've worked with some talented young players, so if you ever come across one that's in a funk and can't get over a loss, what advice do you give them? Or would you give them?
To give advice for who, once again?
Someone who is having trouble recovering from a difficult loss, or
from different situations.
Well, maybe similar to something that you, not like playing for the world championship, but...
Yeah, take it easy, I would say. It's not your last loss. It's not loss, your last defeat. You keep playing, you can keep working hard, you will have so many defeats that you soon will forget this one.
Uh-huh. And
take it professionally, like professionals should take any loss. You just learn from every game, win, loss, whatever. Just you have a long, long road, and you're going through this long road, and maybe you last in the beginning of this road. And all you do, you're learning with every game, every move, every tournament, and so on. But just go, play, enjoy, learn.
Good advice for sure. And you also talk in the book about some of your kind of most common rivals, like Alexei Dreev, who you played through decades, and you make a few references to having not much success against Vasily Ivanchuk. Is there any one player you would consider your sort of, I don't know if you would call it a rival, because I don't know what your personal relationships are like, but is there any player you dreaded playing most, or where felt like you had kind of the opposite, where you felt like you even though they were a strong player, you had good chances against them?
Well, I tell you that against some players I could not play. I could not stand this the rivalry. My two most unpleasant opponents were Anand and Kasparov. Simply, I could not play against talented and professional
mm-hmm.
guys, and in these two cases, probably they are very professional and very talented. And for me, it was not easy to play against Ashirov and Ivanchuk. I also would say that for example, Ivanchuk, he is extremely talented. Shirov, same, less professional, more talented. So that's the point. The guys who had some very strong side, which I could not stand. For example, Chukio was good theoretician. Shirov could conduct initiative perfectly, and so on. And against some, like talented, famous players, I could play relatively easy, like against Topalov, for example, against Karpov, and even I could play against Kramnik more or less, okay, all right. Also, there could be reasons about that, why against some players I could play, against some I could not. But mostly I could like compete with most people of my generation. But like I'm not the only one who could not play against Anand and Kasparov, believe me.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, but the fact that you could hold your own against Topalov, Karpov, and Kramnik is not many people can say that.
Not Polgar.
Okay, so before we let you go, Evgeny, if you're okay with it, we got to get some chess improvement advice, some book recommendations. What do you keep up with the literature, or are you? These, like, if a new chess book comes out, how frequently are you checking it out? I see that, for example, Anish Giri and Magnus Carlsen have been going back and forth on Twitter about the new Tukmakov book. Do you keep up with stuff like that or not so much?
I cannot give any conclusion about Tukmakov's book, and so far I have not read it. What I noticed that a couple ironic comments about this book. Mm-hmm. And probably book is perfect, I'm sure. Tukmakov is an extremely smart guy. But what I can tell you that about coaches, trainers in general, I tell you that chess trainers, they think too much about themselves. Mm-hmm. They believe that their role in players' growth is high. I don't believe this. I think that coach can help maybe a little bit, but lion's part of success on the player's shoulders. And probably Tukmakov explains how much he helped to he can help to chess players. And my personal experience says, okay, if someone is going to become a strong player, he will be. You cannot even hurt too much. Hmm. Sooner or later, he will recover your influence. And if you're asking me about particular books, I read, no, I just buy randomly, and I just go through book in a chess store. And if I like a book, I buy it. If I don't, I don't. Recently bought books by Gulko. I bought books by Seravan. I just actually like those books. I also buy books in Russian if I like them. Gelfand's books are perfect, but I would not say that I'm like Matthew Sadler, just read everything and give my expert's conclusion. I'm not an expert, first of all. Just I'm not a reader, I'm a writer. But some people, I believe in some people, in mind of some people, and also I believe that some people were good players. Good players, and I can buy and enjoy those books. I even bought one book by Matthew Sadler.
The Alpha Zero book?
No. That's old one where he just explains amateurs that he just returned to chess, and now he's he decided that he shows his own way how he recovered, why after 20 years of absence now he's again a strong player, how he works on chess, on openings, and so on.
Chess for Life, I think, the one where
he's He's teaching amateurs how to become same smart as him.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, and yeah, I read. But about AlphaZero, no, I did not buy it so far, and I believe I won't.
Okay, it's interesting because I thought about AlphaZero a little bit when you were talking about Say No to Chess Principles, because of course it's programmed differently.
I tell you why. I saw one game played by AlphaZero in chess and New in Chess in magazine New in Chess. I saw one game AlphaZero played against some other program. I was absolutely impressed. I realized this is the level I will never understand, and the humans will never understand. I was pretty much shocked how AlphaZero could beat other chess program. So, and after that, I understand you can write anything about AlphaZero. It won't be too much. So really, I was impressed, but that's it. I think I more or less imagine how strong Alpha is, and I imagine how humans are weak. But that's the thing it is. So we cannot change anything, and humans, they're just weak, and that's it.
Okay, that's interesting coming from a 2700, but I get in comparison, AlphaZero is playing at another level for sure. So I just have two questions from listeners. If we could bang these out before I let you go, Evgeny, and this one
sure.
is related to chess improvement. It's from Mr. Moonmaster 9000, frequent submitter of questions. Thank you for the support, Mr. Moonmaster. So Moonmaster asks, according to the biography I read of you, you've worked quite a bit as a trainer. Do you have a particular method of instruction that you use for all of your students? If so, what is your method? So you just touched on this, I think. But...
Don't have any particular. Just as I said, I believe that you should develop many skills being a chess player. And I personally don't work with students on chess openings. And I try to develop, to improve all other aspects of chess game. I work on middle game, end game, tactics, and so on. So I also try to explain how important to be like rounded chess player, to be like good sportsman, to keep to sleep well, and so on. Just mm-hmm. how you should be devoted to chess in general to achieve the aim goal you have. That's it. So I'm trying to make a person better, stronger, and so on. So, but nothing particular. I just use all possible information we have in chess to make students.
So how come no openings?
Openings only if one particular asks me, because it takes some time, and if a student believes exactly what he needs right now, especially if I see myself that this is what he needs. Of course, I also do it, but it's not the first thing I work on.
Okay. And how important do you think it's, do you think one aspect is more important for people to emphasize more than others in terms of how to study chess, like studying, analyzing grandmaster games versus analyzing one's own games versus doing tactics, or you just think?
I think two things. First of all, your own games, and second, the middle game.
Okay.
Because when you don't play well middle game, you won't see end game.
So, how would you go about working on the middle game?
Middle game, just Serova. Open Sirawan's book. Read this book and you will improve.
Okay. Excellent advice.
Well, for example, I mean books. Books help.
Okay.
Just communication with strong, growing players help, and so on. Just a lot of things. So you can make many, many things, but chess game just will recognize you as a chess devotee and will help you if chess game can see that you like and love chess and you want to become better. Just be with chess. Do something.
Yeah, just
you
immerse
will
yourself.
Find a way to become better. The life will give you the opportunity. Just once show up, you want to become good in chess.
Okay. And last topic, I was just curious. So you moved to Canada and to Toronto, the Toronto area, fairly late in life. So what, if you don't mind talking about it, what brought that change about?
Yeah, I got your point. I did not move early because I settled here in 2007. And I felt like I settled here with my family, wife, and two kids. But it turned out that my wife, she did not like Canada. She did not feel well here. She actually could not find a job which would satisfy her. And she returned to Moscow. But originally, the idea was, of course, to give a chance to my family, to give chance to my kids, and just to give them choice, to choice of moves to make. Russia, Canada, and... But, you know, we say in Russia that if in a play a rifle is on a wall in the beginning of the play, in the last minute the rifle will shoot. And in 2007 I got this permanent residency card, and it in 10 years I decided to settle. In 7 years, I decided to settle down myself in Canada. So the rifle shot.
Chekhov's gun, yeah. So are you enjoying life there?
Well, let me answer this question in 1 week, because in 1 week I have my oath. And before that...
No comment.
Yeah, no comments until then.
Okay. And just one last question from a supporter of the podcast. I mentioned in the little write-ups I do for the supporters of the podcast that you have a lot of literary references in your chess books, from, you know, Master and Margarita to Dostoevsky, who you mentioned earlier, and Nabokov, a little Nabokov segue in from London to Elista. So this was a question from Jerry Wells, who asks, can you compare the spark of a perfectly weighted sentence in a novel to that of a brilliant move in a chess game? Does one pleasure run deeper than the other for you?
I prefer player, novel, chess game to be perfect. So all moves should be good. All sentences should be great. So the novel would be perfect. So... I wish everything around me would be as perfect as possible. So no bad moves, no bad sentences. So I like perfection. Okay, if I would call it perfectionist. And in fact, I do not, the readers, they should not overestimate me. And of course, I like literature. But if you listen to professionals, and I understand what means to be professional in literature, when you're reading and listening to a professional, professionals, then that's the level. That's, for example, I can explain and understand in a chess game much more without than like normal human without computer. So about literature. Well, I just read, but I'm just an amateur there. I like good literature, but I'm not that good as I wish I could be. So but I love good things and good things everywhere. Perfect things.
Yeah. Well, having been
if you got my point.
Yeah. I mean, having been a top five, excuse me, one of the elite chess players in the world, that's a hard level to attain in the sphere of literature.
Impossible. Yeah. much easier to attain the level in chess rather than in literature.
Well, yeah, easy for you to say. I don't know about the rest of us, but in any event, I don't know. There's room for both. Do you have a game that you feel like you? Do you have a game that you've played where you felt like you came close to perfection? Do you have any games that you're particularly proud of?
In the book or in general?
In general.
The thing is, you should understand, and one should understand, when you play chess for some time, and when computers were born, that for chess player, extremely difficult to create a perfect game. So probably I never played a perfect game, but I played good games. And for example, if I remember correctly, Fischer's book is my 60 memorable games. So what we can play, we can play memorable games where after those games we have good reminiscences and let's say that the games they change something in our life. So I had memorable games, but as I said, I wrote this book like one of my book, and maybe in another 10 years I'll write another book with those memorable games where I'll also put some good ones.
Okay, that would be awesome. And I would love to have you back in 10 years.
Yeah.
if this project were to come to fruition. But meanwhile, listeners, this book is highly enjoyable. You'll learn some chess. You'll hear some incredible stories. So thank you for taking the time to write this. I know you mentioned in the introduction that you tried to avoid it for as long as you could. So I'm glad that you finally made the effort.
I did. Thank you for asking me to be with you.
Oh, my pleasure. And one last question. I don't know if do you share contact information, or would you rather I keep that private? If listeners would like to either contact you or track you, is there any way publicly, or should we leave you alone as a private citizen?
I am. I have contact in Facebook.
Okay, great.
You can easily find me there, Evgeny Bareev, and be my guest.
Excellent. I will add that.
Write a couple words, send me text, I'll answer.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my producer, Matthew Passy, Geert Vandervelt, for supplying the theme music, my wonderful guests, of course. And I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about the show, whether it's on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram, telling an actual friend, an actual person about it. Every little bit helps grow the show. But most of all, I want to thank people who support the show financially. Without your financial support, this show would not be possible. I love doing it, but it is a lot of work. So I most of all want to thank Chessable for their support, and I also would like to give extra special thanks to the following people and entities: Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Handelman, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, Dan O'Hanlon, I am Dimitri Schneider, Greg Shahadi, Guven Manet, Jens Green, John Jernigan, Kelly Palmer, Lone Pine Chess, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Sydney Andrews, Thomas Tachenko, and Todd Bryant. And I'd also like to thank the following Patreon partners. You guys are Aaron Wafflart, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancouge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brett Zeldo, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Bumgardner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas of the U.S. Chess Federation, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Elect, Donnie Ariel, the Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Frank Tortoris, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt of Chessable.com, Gerard Barda, Giovanni Russo, Greg Natel, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, Jen Shahadi, Jerry Wells, JJ Strand, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovyutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Boyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Martin Knudsen, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the mysterious Moon Master 9000, the legend grows, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Neil Bruce, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paolo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Brandy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancouge, William Peterson, Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks, everyone. Catch you guys next week.
Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.